man identified as Fred Tin was in fact Fred Tyers, who had died. Teresa Desley was in fact Teresa Feely, who perished along with her husband James. There were two Mrs. Hammonds. One lived. The other, Ogden's wife, died. Two waiters were named John Leach. One survived, the other did not. A dead passenger named Greenfield was in fact Green Shields. Time zones and sluggish communication made it even harder on friends and kin. Those who could afford the cost sent cables to Cunard with detailed descriptions of their loved ones, down to the serial numbers stamped on their watches, but these cables took hours to receive, transcribe, and deliver. In those first days after the disaster, thousands of cables flooded Cunard's offices. Cunard had little information to provide. The dead collected at Queenstown were placed in three makeshift morgues, including Town Hall, where they were placed side by side on the floor. Whenever possible, children were placed beside their mothers. Survivors moved in slow, sad lines, looking for lost kin. There were reunions of a happier sort as well. Seaman Leslie Morton spent Friday night looking for his brother Cliff on the lists of survivors and in the hotels of Queenstown, but found no trace. Early the next morning, he sent a telegram to his father, "Am saved, looking for Cliff." He went to one of the morgues. Laid out in rows all the way down on both sides were sheeted and shrouded bodies, he wrote, and a large number of people in varying states of sorrow and distress were going from body to body, turning back the sheets to see if they could identify loved ones who had not yet been found. He worked his way along, lifting sheets. Just as he was about to pull yet one more, he saw the hand of another searcher reaching for the same sheet. He looked over and saw his brother. Their reaction was deadpan. "Hello, Cliff. Glad to see you," Leslie said. "Am I glad to see you too, Gert," Cliff said. "I think we ought to have a drink on this." As it happened, their father had not had to spend very much time worrying. He had received telegrams from both sons, telling him each was looking for the other. The telegrams, Leslie later learned, had arrived 5 minutes apart, so that Father knew at home that we were both safe before we did. That night, Leslie had his first ever Guinness. I cannot say that I thought much of it in those days, but it seemed a good thing in which to celebrate being alive, having got together again, and being in Ireland. The rescue ships brought in many of the bodies, but many others were recovered from the coves and beaches of Ireland as the sea brought them ashore. One man's body was found on a beach clutching a foot-long fragment of a lifeboat, which later would find its way into the archives of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, the wood still bearing the brand Lusitania. Consul Frost took responsibility for managing the American dead. The important bodies, meaning those in first class, were embalmed at U.S. expense. There was a curious effacement of social or mental distinction by death, and we often believed a corpse to be important when it turned out to be decidedly the opposite, Frost wrote. The commonest expression was one of reassured tranquility, yet with an undertone of puzzlement or aggrievement, as though some trusted friend had played a practical joke which the victim did not yet understand. The unimportant bodies were sealed inside lead coffins so that they could be returned to America whenever desired. Cunard went to great lengths to number, photograph, and catalog the recovered bodies. Body number one was that of Catherine Gill, a 40-year-old widow. Body number 91 was that of Chief Purser McCubbin, for whom this was to be the last voyage before retirement. Nearly all the dead were photographed in coffins, though one lies in what appears to be a large wheelbarrow, and a toddler rests on a makeshift platform. They still wear their coats, suits, dresses, and jewelry. A mother and tiny daughter, presumably found together, share a coffin. The mother is turned toward her daughter. The child lies with one arm resting across her mother's chest. They look as though they could step from this coffin and resume their lives. Others convey the same restful aspect. A handsome, clean-shaven man in his 30s, body number 59, lies dressed neatly in white shirt, tweed jacket, polka-dotted bow tie, and dark overcoat. The textures are comforting. The buttons on his overcoat are shiny, like new. These photographs beg viewers to imagine last moments. Here is body number 165, a girl in a white dress with a lacy top. Hair flung back, mouth open as if in a scream, her whole aspect is one of fear and pain. One victim, identified only as body number 109, is that of a stout woman who lies naked under a rough blanket, her hair still flecked with sand. Unlike all the other bodies in this collection of photographs, her eyes are squeezed tightly shut. Her cheeks are puffed, her lips are tightly clamped. She looks uncannily, as if she were still holding her breath. The most unsettling image here is that of body number 156, a girl of about 3, slightly chubby, with curly blonde hair, wearing a pullover sweater with overlong sleeves. What is troubling is the child's expression. She looks perturbed. Someone laid flowers across her chest and at her side, but she seems unmollified. She lies on a wood pallet beside what appears to be a life jacket. Her expression is one of pure fury. Consul Frost found the sight of so many drowned children difficult to expunge from his thoughts. He had a young daughter of his own. Several weeks after the disaster, one night out at my home, I went into a bedroom with a lighted match and came unexpectedly upon the sleeping form of my own little daughter, he wrote. For an instant, his mind was jolted back to scenes he had witnessed in the morgues. I give you my word, I recoiled as though I had found a serpent. The search for bodies still adrift in the sea continued until June, when Kennard suggested to Frost that the time had come to halt the effort. He concurred. The search was suspended on June 4th, but bodies continued to wash ashore well into the summer. The later a body was recovered, the higher its assigned number, the worse its condition. Two men came ashore in County Kerry on July 14th and 15th, some 200 miles by sea from the wreck. One wore a cleric's clothing and had perfect teeth, according to a report on the find, which noted much of the body was eaten away. The second had no head, arms, or feet, but like some tentacled sea creature, dragged behind him a full complement of clothing. Blue serge trousers, black and white striped flannel shirt, woolen undershirt, undershorts, suspenders, a belt, and a keychain with 7 keys. To encourage reporting of new arrivals, Kennard offered a £1 reward. Frost offered an additional pound to anyone who recovered a corpse that was demonstrably a U.S. citizen. On July 11, 1915, one American did come ashore, at Stradbally, Ireland. At first, authorities believed him to be a Lusitania victim and designated him body number 248. He had not been a passenger, however. His name was Leon C. Thrasher, the American who had gone missing on March 28th when the SS Falaba was torpedoed and sunk. He had been in the water 106 days. The people who discovered remains treated them with great respect, despite their often grotesque condition. Such was the case when the body of a middle-aged man was found on Ireland's Dingle Peninsula on July 17th, 71 days after the disaster. The currents and winds had taken him on a long journey around the southwest rim of Ireland before depositing him at Brandon Bay, a distance of about 250 miles from Queenstown. His body was discovered by a local citizen, who notified the Royal Irish Constabulary in Castle Gregory, 6 miles to the east. A sergeant, Jay Regan, promptly set out by bicycle, accompanied by a constable, and soon arrived at the scene, an austere but lovely beach. Here they found what little remained of an apparently male corpse. That the man had come from the Lusitania was obvious. Part of a life jacket was still attached to the body, and another portion lay nearby, marked Lusitania. There was little question as to his identity. When the officers went through what remained of the man's clothing, they found a watch with the initials V-O-E-S stamped on its case, and a knife marked Victor E. Shields, and a letter addressed to Mr. Victor Shields, care of steamer Lusitania. The letter was dated April 30th, 1915, the day before the ship left New York. In one pocket, the officers discovered a copy of an entertainment program from the ship. The documents were soaked. The officers laid them in the sun to dry. Sergeant Regan noted that the tide was rising quickly, so I sent for a sheet and placed the body on it and carried it from the tide to a place of safety. He then cycled to a telegraph office and wired the local coroner, who replied that no inquest would be necessary. The police ordered a lead casket and wooden shell, and by evening Shields was placed in a swan's down robe and coffined within. The undertaker took the coffin to a private home, where it remained until the next day when police buried it in a nearby graveyard. Everything was done that could be done by the police, Sergeant Regan wrote in a letter to Consul Frost. In fact, they could do no more for a member of their family, and I, on behalf of the police, tender Mrs. Shields our sincere sympathy in her bereavement. For disbelieving families struck by grief, it was important to know precisely how their loved ones had died, whether by drowning, exposure, or physical trauma. The Shields family took this to extremes and ordered the body disinterred. The family wanted an autopsy. This was easier asked than achieved. Needless to say, wrote Frost, it proved virtually impossible to procure a physician of advanced years and high standing to dissect remains 75 days after decease. Frost did manage to find two younger doctors who were willing to take on the task. The character of this endeavor was made clear in the report of one of the physicians, Dr. John Higgins, acting house surgeon of Cork's North Infirmary. The autopsy began at 2:30, July 23rd, at the office of an undertaker. The second doctor was to perform his own autopsy the next day. A plumber now opened the lead casket in which Victor Shields lay, and soon the scent of heated lead was joined by another sort of odor. Consul Frost was present for this, but Higgins noted that at a point about halfway through the autopsy he left when he was called away. In life, by Higgins' estimate, Shields had weighed 14 or 15 stone, or roughly 200 pounds. His body was now in an advanced state of decomposition, Higgins noted. This was an understatement. The soft parts of his face and head were entirely absent, including the scalp, Higgins wrote. The majority of the teeth were missing, including all the front teeth. The hands were also absent, and the soft parts of the upper right arm. The back of the calf of the right leg was largely absent, as was a portion of the left calf. The genitals were very much decomposed, virtually missing. Mr. Shields lay there smiling up at them, but not in an endearing fashion. I examined the skull, Dr. Higgins wrote. Externally, it was totally bare as far as the lower part of the occipital bone. The occipital forms the bottom rear portion of the skull. I removed the skull cap and found that the brain was too much decomposed for examination, but the membranes were intact. He removed the brain and examined the interior of the skull. He found no evidence of fracture at its base or to the cervical canal. This ruled out death by falling debris or other blunt trauma to the head. Nor did he discover any fractures along the spine or injury to the back. Shields's internal organs likewise failed to reveal what killed him, but they did provide Dr. Higgins with a look at what remained of the man's last lunch aboard the Lusitania. The stomach contained roughly a pint of a green semi-solid mass, apparently semi-digested food, but contained no water as such. The lack of a clear cause of death was perplexing. In my opinion, Higgins wrote, there is no injury present which would account for death. There is no evidence of drowning, and the probability is that death was brought about as a result of shock or exposure, probably the former. From the contents of the stomach, it would appear that death supervened within a very few hours after his last meal, possibly from 2 to 3 hours. After all that, the finding was death with no obvious cause. The other physician reached the same conclusion. The peripatetic Mr. Shields was returned to his coffin and shipped to America. Consul Frost, in a letter to Washington, praised the effort taken by the police after the discovery of Shields's body. It would be a most graceful and commendable act if the estate of Mr. Shields should forward from 2 to 5 pounds to the sergeant and his colleagues for the excellent spirit in which they discharged their duties. The mystery as to what killed Shields remained, leaving the family to wonder what horror he had endured. This same fate fell to nearly all the kin of the dead. There can be no doubt that for many passengers death came suddenly and utterly by surprise. The dozens of crewmen who were in the luggage bay at the time of impact were killed instantly by the force of the torpedo blast. But exactly how many and who they were was not known. Passengers were crushed by descending boats. Swimmers were struck by chairs, boxes, potted plants, and other debris falling from the decks high above. And then there were those most ill-starred of passengers who had put on their life preservers incorrectly and found themselves floating with their heads submerged, legs up, as in some devil's comedy. One can only imagine the final minutes of the Crumpton parents and their children. How do you save a child, let alone 6 children, especially when one of them is an infant and one is 6 years old? None of the Cromptons survived. 5 of the children were never found. The infant, Master Peter Romilly Crompton, about 9 months old, was body number 214. Cunard Chairman Booth knew the family well. My own personal loss is very great, he wrote in a May 8th letter to Cunard's New York manager, Charles Sumner. We are all at one in our feelings with regard to this terrible disaster to the Lusitania, and it is quite hopeless to try to put anything in writing. Sumner wrote back that the loss of the ship and so many passengers is sad beyond expression. The many unidentified bodies in the 3 morgues presented Cunard officials with an awkward predicament, and one that needed to be addressed quickly. The bodies, some 140 of them, had begun to decompose, at a rate quickened by the warm spring weather. The company decided on a mass burial. Each body would have its own coffin. Mothers and babies would share. But all would be interred together in 3 separate excavations, lettered A, B, and C, in the old church cemetery on a hillside outside Queenstown. The date was set for Monday, May 10th. All the previous day and throughout the night, soldiers dug the graves and undertakers coffined the bodies, leaving the lids off as long as possible to encourage last-minute identifications. Owing to a shortage of vehicles, the coffins were transported in shifts beginning early Monday morning, but three coffins were held back for the actual funeral procession, which was to begin in the afternoon. Trains brought mourners and the curious. Shops closed for the day and pulled their blinds and fastened their shutters. Ship captains ordered flags hung at half-mast. As the procession advanced through Queenstown, a military band played Chopin's funeral march. Clerics led the cortege, among them Father Cowley Clark of London, himself a survivor of the disaster. Soldiers and mourners followed. U.S. Consul Frost walked as well. Soldiers and citizens lined the entire route, standing bareheaded as a measure of respect. The road they followed passed through hills of vivid green stippled with wildflowers and slashed here and there by the garish yellow of blooming gorse. The sky was clear and without cloud, and in the distant harbor boats dipped and nodded in a light breeze. "A picture of peace," wrote one reporter, "that gave no hint of the recent tragedy." The procession bearing the three coffins arrived at the cemetery about 3 o'clock and stopped at the edge of the graves. The many other coffins, each an elongated diamond of elm, had been laid neatly within, arranged in two tiers, the body numbers and locations carefully mapped so that if the photographs and lists of personal effects catalogued by Cunard led to subsequent identifications, the families would at least know the exact whereabouts of their loved ones. As the three coffins were lowered into the graves, the crowd sang, "Abide with Me." Gunfire followed from a ceremonial guard, and a squad of buglers played "The Last Post," the British military's equivalent of taps. Soldiers converged and began filling the graves. A photograph shows a line of small boys standing on the hillock of excavated soil, watching with avid interest as the soldiers below fill the crevices between coffins. It was lovely, and dignified, and deeply moving. But this mass burial imposed a psychic cost on Ken, who learned belatedly that their own loved ones were interred within. Cunard's final count found that of these anonymous dead, about half were later identified using personal effects and photographs. For some families, the idea of their kin resting alone in that far-off terrain was too hard to bear. The family of Elizabeth A. Seccombe, a 38-year-old woman from Peterborough, New Hampshire, pleaded with Consul Frost for help in retrieving her and bringing her home. She was the daughter of a Cunard captain who had died some years earlier. Her body was number 164, buried on May 14th in Grave B, 6th row, upper tier. Frost did what he could. He argued that Seccombe's location in the grave made her coffin particularly easy to locate. Though very much a miser when it came to U.S. funds, he went so far as to offer £100 to cover costs. The British government was willing, but the local council said no, and its decision held sway. In part, the council was influenced by local superstition, religious prejudice, Frost called it, but mainly it did not want to set a precedent. At least 20 other families had sought to disinter their loved ones and had been refused. "The council's stance," Frost wrote, "is incomprehensible to me." The greatest burden by far was borne by the relatives of the many passengers and crew whose bodies were never found. Of the 791 passengers designated by Cunard as missing, only 173 bodies, or about 22%, were eventually recovered, leaving 618 souls unaccounted for. The percentage for the crew was even more dismal, owing no doubt to the many deaths in the luggage room when the torpedo exploded. Alice and Elbert Hubbard were never found, nor was Kansas City passenger Theodore Nash. In Queenstown, his wife Belle roamed for a time with young Robert Kay as he recovered from his measles and waited for his grandfather to come and claim him. Joseph Frankham, who had huddled with his family in an unlaunched boat during the Lusitania's last moments, survived, as did one of his sons. But his wife, his baby daughter, and his 4-year-old son were lost. Nellie Houston never got to mail that charming diary-like letter in which she confessed that the size of her derriere impeded her access to her birth. The letter was found in a purse floating on the sea. The three members of the Luck family, 34-year-old Charlotte and her 2 young sons, disappeared as well. Alfred Vanderbilt was never found, despite a $5,000 reward, a fortune offered by the Vanderbilt family. Charles Laureate's friend and traveling companion, Lothrop Withington, likewise disappeared. The absence of so many bodies raised haunting questions for families. Were their loved ones now among the anonymous corpses buried at Queenstown? Were they locked somewhere within the hall, owing to an ill-advised last-minute dash for a personal belonging? Did chivalry do them in, or cowardice? Or did they suffer a fate like that of one unidentified woman, whose body came to rest on Straw Island off Galway, where she was found by the keeper of the island's lighthouse? She was wearing her body life jacket correctly, and had drifted alone for 36 days. Mothers lost children and would be left forever to imagine their final moments, or to wonder if somehow, miraculously, their babies had actually been saved and were now in the care of another. Nora Bretherton, the Los Angeles woman who had handed her Betty to a stranger, was spared that brand of haunting. Betty was body number 156. Her mother buried her in the graveyard at the Ursuline Convent in Cork. Bretherton's son survived. For families at home waiting for news, the absence of a body left them suspended somewhere between hope and grief. One mother set out to learn as much as possible about her lost boy, Preston Pritchard. She was aided by her surviving son, Mostyn, who traveled to Queenstown to search the morgues. "The place is alive with miserable creatures like ourselves," he wrote. He found no trace of his brother. "It is bewildering to know what to do." Mrs. Pritchard wrote to dozens of survivors, and on the basis of information she received, she wrote to dozens more. She sent a flyer with Preston's picture and a detailed description. Among those she contacted was Grace French, Pritchard's dining companion, who told Mrs. Pritchard that she believed herself to be the last person on the ship to have spoken with him. In one of several letters, French told Mrs. Pritchard that she had thought of her son often, and of their interrupted excursion to find her double on board. French wrote, "I can see his face so clearly in my mind, so sunburned and full of life and ambition." The many replies offered a fresh view of the voyage and of the trials and sorrows of the last day. The writers recalled fleeting glimpses of Pritchard, especially his gregariousness and popularity, and offered their own stories. Mostly, though, survivors tried to offer some small bit of consolation, despite having had only glancing contact with Pritchard, or none at all. They assured Mrs. Pritchard that her son, given his physical prowess, must surely have been helping women and children up to the last moment. Theodate Pope, ever true to her spiritualist beliefs, wrote to Mrs. Pritchard on February 4, 1916, "I beg of you not to dwell on the thought of what has become of the physical part of the boy you love," she urged. "Can you not constantly keep in mind that whatever has happened to his body has not in any way affected his spirit, and that surely lives and will await reunion with you?" A second-class passenger named Ruth M. Wordsworth of Salisbury, England, sought to address the disparity between how things actually unfolded on the ship and the nightmarish scenes conjured in the minds of next of kin. I know you must be tempted to have most terrible imaginings. May I tell you that although it was very awful, it was not so ghastly as you are sure to imagine it. When the thing really comes, God gives to each the help he needs to live or to die. She described the quiet and the lack of panic among passengers. They were calm, many of them quite cheerful, and everyone was trying to do the sensible thing. The men were forgetting themselves and seeing after the women and children. They could not do much, because the list prevented the launching of most of the boats, but they were doing their best and playing the man. Of the four men in Preston Pritchard's cabin, D-90, only one survived, his friend Arthur Gadsden. Pritchard's body was never recovered, yet in the red volume that now contains the beautifully archived replies to Mrs. Pritchard's letters, there exists a surprisingly vivid sense of him, as though he resided still in the peripheral vision of the world. Part 5. The Sea of Secrets. London. Blame. What happened next came as a surprise to Captain Turner. Even though the cause of the disaster was obvious, an act of war, the Admiralty moved at once to place the blame on him. Anyone privy to the internal communications or minutes flung between the offices of senior Admiralty officials in the week after the disaster could have had no doubt as to the zeal with which the Admiralty intended to forge a case against Turner. In one, Churchill himself wrote, "We should pursue the captain without check." Before the effort could get started, however, the coroner in Kinsale, Ireland, John J. Horgan, convened an inquest of his own, much to the Admiralty's displeasure. Horgan claimed the responsibility fell to him because five of the Lusitania's dead had been landed in his district. The inquest began the day after the sinking, Saturday, May 8th. Horgan called Turner as a witness, and after hearing his testimony, praised the captain for his courage in staying with the ship until the last moment. At this, Turner began to cry. Horgan, in a later memoir, called the captain a brave but unlucky man. On Monday, May 10th, the coroner's jury issued its finding that the submarine's officers and crew and the Emperor of Germany had committed willful and wholesale murder. Half an hour later, a message arrived from the Admiralty ordering Horgan to block Turner from testifying. Horgan wrote, "That august body were, however, as belated on this occasion as they had been in protecting the Lusitania against attack." The Admiralty was far more prompt in laying out the contours of its strategy for assigning fault to Turner. The day after the disaster, Richard Webb, director of the Admiralty's trade division, circulated a 2-page memorandum marked "Secret," in which he charged that Turner had ignored the Admiralty's instructions that called for him to zigzag and to give prominent headlands a wide berth. Instead, Webb wrote, Turner had proceeded along the usual trade route at a speed approximately 3/4 of what he was able to get out of this vessel. He thus kept his valuable vessel for an unnecessary length of time in the area where she was most liable to attack, inviting disaster. Webb made a formal request for an investigation by Britain's Wreck Commission under Lord Mersey, who had led inquiries into the losses of many ships, including the Titanic and the Empress of Ireland. On Wednesday, May 12th, Webb intensified his attack on Captain Turner. In a new memorandum, he wrote that Turner appears to have displayed an almost inconceivable negligence, and one is forced to conclude that he is either utterly incompetent or that he has been got at by the Germans. In the left-hand margin, First Sea Lord Fisher, in his wild, fulminating hand, jotted, "I hope Captain Turner will be arrested immediately after the inquiry, whatever the verdict of finding may be." The Admiralty took the unprecedented step of insisting that key parts of the planned inquiry, especially the examination of Turner, be held in secret. U.S. Consul Frost sensed early on that the Admiralty's soul had hardened against Turner. On Sunday, May 9th, Frost paid a call on Admiral Koch, senior naval officer in Queenstown, accompanied by two U.S. military attachés who had just arrived from London to help arrange the return of American dead. Admiral Koch openly criticized Turner for sailing too close to shore and too slowly, and read aloud the warnings that had been sent to the Lusitania on Friday. But Consul Frost was surprised at how little detail these messages contained. Bare facts only, Frost noted later. No instructions or interpretation. It is true that Turner should have kept farther out, but to my mind it seemed that the Admiralty had by no means done their full duty by him. One of the American attachés, Captain W.A. Castle, wrote his own account of the meeting and noted that a particular subject was glaringly absent from the conversation. "I was struck by the fact that the Admiral, while seeming to be desirous of justifying the Admiralty in its measures of protection, did not mention the presence of any destroyers or other naval vessels." Castle added that during his train trip back to London, he had discussed the subject with a fellow passenger, a Royal Navy lieutenant, who spoke quite frankly, although I suppose of course confidentially, and said that he could not understand, nor could his brother officers, why so many torpedo boats of the old type, which could make 25 knots an hour without difficulty and would be just the thing to protect an incoming steamer, are left at various wharves instead of being used for this purpose, and said that had they placed one of these to starboard, another to port, and another in front of the Lusitania, she could not have been torpedoed. Why the Admiralty would seek to assign fault to Turner defies ready explanation, given that isolating Germany as the sole offender would do far more to engender global sympathy for Britain and cement animosity toward Germany. By blaming Turner, however, the Admiralty hoped to divert attention from its own failure to safeguard the Lusitania. Questioned on the matter in the House of Commons on May 10, 1915, Churchill had replied rather coolly, "Merchant traffic must look after itself." But there were other secrets to protect, not just from domestic scrutiny, but also from German watchers, namely the fact that the Admiralty, through Room 40, had known so much about U-20's travels leading up to the attack. One way to defend those secrets was to draw attention elsewhere. The Admiralty found added motivation to do so when, on May 12th, wireless stations in Britain's listening network intercepted a series of messages from the then homebound U-20, which upon entering the North Sea had resumed communication with its base at Emden. At the Admiralty, these messages drew an unusual degree of attention. Room 40 asked all the stations that had intercepted them to confirm that they had transcribed them correctly and to provide signed and certified copies. In the first message of the series, Schwieger reported, "Have sunk off the south coast of Ireland one sailing ship, two steamers, and Lusitania. Am steering for the mouth of the Ems." The Admiralty received it at 9:49 a.m. The decrypted copy was marked "Most Secret." This message confirmed that the culprit had indeed been U-20, the submarine that Room 40 had been tracking since April 30th. That afternoon, Room 40 received the intercept of a reply sent to Schwieger by the commander of Germany's High Seas Fleet, which read, My highest appreciation of Commander and crew for the success they have achieved. I'm proud of their achievement and express best wishes for their return. Then came a third message sent from Schwieger to his base. After detailing the latitude and longitude of his attack on the Lusitania, Schwieger noted that he had sunk the ship by means of one torpedo. This was a surprise. By now, the prevailing view in the world's press was that the Lusitania had been sunk by two torpedoes, and that these accounted for the two major explosions reported by passengers. But now the Room 40 Cognoscenti knew without doubt that Schwieger had fired only one torpedo. And this, they understood, raised sensitive questions. How could a single torpedo sink a ship the size of the Lusitania? And if there was no second torpedo, what exactly caused the second explosion? They recognized also that Schwieger's message had to be kept secret at all costs, for it was precisely this kind of special knowledge that could tip Germany to the existence of Room 40. By the time the Mersey inquiry began on June 15, 1915, the British government had undergone one of its periodic upheavals amid controversy over the shell shortage on the Western Front and the failure, at great cost in lives and ships, of Churchill's plan to force the Dardanelles. New men ran the Admiralty. Fisher had resigned, and Churchill had been jettisoned. These changes, however, caused no easing of the campaign against Captain Turner. After preliminary public testimony from several witnesses, including Turner, who briefly described his experience in the disaster, Lord Mersey convened the first of the secret sessions and again called Turner to the witness box. The Admiralty's lead attorney, Sir Edward Carson, Attorney General, questioned the captain in harsh fashion, as if the proceeding were a murder trial with Turner the prime suspect. Carson clearly hoped to prove that Turner had ignored the Admiralty's directives, in particular its instructions to keep to a mid-channel course. Turner testified that by his own standards he was in mid-channel. Under ordinary circumstances, he said, he passed the old head of Kinsale at distances as close as a mile. Indeed, one photograph of the Lusitania shows the ship steaming at full speed past the old head at the maritime equivalent of a hair's breadth. At the time of the attack, the ship, by Turner's reckoning, had been a dozen miles off, maybe as many as 15. Years later, a diver would pinpoint the wreck's location at 11¾ miles from Kinsale Head. Carson also badgered Turner as to why the Lusitania was moving at only 18 knots when it was torpedoed, and challenged the wisdom of the captain's plan to reduce speed in order to arrive at the Mersey Bar off Liverpool at a time when he could sail into the harbor without stopping. Carson argued that if Turner had zigzagged at top speed, he could have evaded the submarine, and owing to the time consumed by the frequent course changes, would still have made the bar on time. Carson let pass the fact that although Turner was not deliberately zigzagging, his several changes of course that morning to set up his four-point bearing did describe a zigzag pattern, with fatal result. The last starboard turn put him directly in U-20's path. Turner's own lawyer, Butler Espinall, Britain's leading expert in maritime law, did his best to sculpt Turner's story into a coherent account of the Lusitania's last morning, and to win for him Lord Mersey's sympathy. I mean to say, we have the very great advantage of knowing so much now which was unknown to him then, Espinall said. We are sitting upon the matter in cool judgment, with an opportunity of looking at the charts, and the circumstances under which we're dealing with it were not the circumstances under which the master would have an opportunity of dealing with it. In all, Lord Mersey heard testimony from 36 witnesses, including passengers, crew, and outside experts. At the conclusion of the inquiry, he defied the Admiralty and absolved Turner of any responsibility for the loss of the Lusitania. In his report, Mersey wrote that Turner exercised his judgment for the best. It was the judgment of a skilled and experienced man, and although others might have acted differently and perhaps more successfully, he ought not, in my opinion, to be blamed. Mersey found Cunard's closure of the ship's fourth boiler room to be irrelevant. The resulting reduction in speed, he wrote, still left the Lusitania a considerably faster ship than any other steamer plying across the Atlantic. Mersey laid blame entirely on the U-boat commander. Turner doubtless was relieved, but according to his son Norman, he also felt he had been unjustly treated. He was very bitter about the way in which, at the inquiry, it was sought to fix the blame on him for the sinking, and particularly to try to condemn him for being on the course he was. Lord Mersey seemed to share this sentiment. Soon afterward, he resigned his post as wreck commissioner, calling the inquiry a damned dirty business. Cunard retained Turner on its roster of captains. At no time during the secret portions of the proceeding did the Admiralty ever reveal what it knew about the travels of U-20, nor did it disclose the measures taken to protect the HMS Orion and other military vessels. Moreover, the Admiralty made no effort to correct Lord Mersey's finding that the Lusitania had been struck by two torpedoes. This despite the fact that Room 40 knew full well that Schwieger had fired only one. Nor did the inquiry ever delve into why the Lusitania wasn't diverted to the safer North Channel route, and why no naval escort was provided. Indeed, these are the great lingering questions of the Lusitania affair. Why, given all the information possessed by the Admiralty about U-20, given the Admiralty's past willingness to provide escorts to inbound ships or divert them away from trouble, given that the ship carried a vital cargo of rifle ammunition and artillery shells, given that Room 40's intelligence prompted the obsessive tracking and protection of the HMS Orion, given that U-20 had sunk three vessels in the Lusitania's path, given Cunard Chairman Booth's panicked Friday morning visit to the Navy's Queenstown office, given that the new and safer North Channel route was available, and given that passengers and crew alike had expected to be convoyed to Liverpool by the Royal Navy, the question remains, why was the ship left on its own, with a proven killer of men and ships dead ahead in its path? There is silence on the subject in the records of Room 40 held by the National Archives of the United Kingdom and Churchill College, Cambridge. Nowhere is there even a hint of dismay at missing so clear an opportunity to use the fruits of Room 40's intelligence to save 1,000 lives. The question perplexed at least one prominent naval historian, the late Patrick Beasley, who during World War II was himself an officer in British naval intelligence. Britain's secrecy laws prevented him from writing about the subject until the 1970s and 1980s, when he published several books, including one about Room 40, said to be a quasi-official account. There he addressed the controversy only obliquely, stating that if no deliberate plan existed to put the Lusitania in danger, one is left only with an unforgivable cock-up as an explanation. However, in a later interview, housed in the archives of the Imperial War Museum, London, Beasley was less judicious. As an Englishman and a lover of the Royal Navy, he said, I would prefer to attribute this failure to negligence, even gross negligence, rather than to a conspiracy deliberately to endanger the ship. But, he said, On the basis of the considerable volume of information which is now available, I am reluctantly compelled to state that, on balance, the most likely explanation is that there was, indeed, a plot, however imperfect, to endanger the Lusitania in order to involve the United States in the war. So much was done for the Orion and other warships, he wrote, but nothing for the Lusitania. He struggled with this. No matter how he arranged the evidence, he came back to conspiracy. He said, "If that's unacceptable, will someone tell me another explanation to these very, very curious circumstances?" The absence of an escort also surprised Cunard's lawyers. In a lengthy confidential memorandum on the Mersey inquiry, written to help a New York attorney defend the company against dozens of American liability claims, Cunard's London firm wrote, "With regard to the question of convoy, Sir Alfred Booth hoped and expected that the Admiralty would send destroyers to meet and convoy the vessel. There were destroyers at Queenstown, and no explanation has been given as to why there was no convoy, except Mr. Winston Churchill's statement that it was impossible for the Admiralty to convoy merchant ships." The memo left unsaid the fact that the Admiralty earlier in the year had, in fact, made provision to escort merchant ships. It was a question that also troubled passengers and crew and the citizens of Queenstown. Third Officer Albert Bestick wrote later that in light of the German warning in New York and the Admiralty's awareness of new submarine activity, some sort of protective force should have been dispatched. Even one destroyer encircling the liner as she entered the danger zone would have minimized the danger, if indeed have not rendered the Lusitania immune from attack with a resulting loss of lives. One of Cunard's most prominent captains, James Bissett, who had served under Turner and was captain of the HMS Caronia when it met the Lusitania off New York shortly after departure, wrote in a memoir, "The neglect to provide naval escort for her in the narrow waters as she approached her destination was all the more remarkable, as no less than 23 British merchant vessels had been torpedoed and sunk by German U-boats near the coasts of Britain and Ireland in the preceding 7 days." As to whether an escort really could have prevented the disaster, Turner himself was ambivalent. "It might," he said during his testimony at the Kinsale coroner's inquest, "but it is one of those things one never knows. The submarine would have probably torpedoed both of us." Another mystery centered on the second explosion within the Lusitania. Its cause would be debated for a century to come, with dark talk of exploding munitions and a secret cargo of explosive materials. There may indeed have been a hidden cache of explosives aboard, but if so, it did not cause the second explosion or contribute to the speed at which the ship sank. The myriad accounts left by survivors fail to describe the kind of vivid cataclysm such an explosion would produce. The rifle ammunition was not likely to have been the culprit either. Testing done several years earlier had determined that such ammunition did not explode en masse when exposed to fire, and this prompted the U.S. Department of Commerce and Labor to approve the shipping of such cargoes aboard passenger vessels. A more plausible theory held that when the torpedo exploded, the concussion shook the ship with such violence that the nearly empty coal bunkers became clouded with explosive coal dust, which then ignited. There is evidence that such a cloud did arise. One fireman, who had been standing in the center of a stokehold, reported hearing the crash of the torpedo and suddenly finding himself engulfed in dust. But this cloud apparently did not ignite. The fireman survived. Here, too, survivors' accounts don't depict the kind of fiery convulsion such an ignition would have produced. Subsequent investigation by forensic engineers concluded that the environment in which the ship's coal was stored was too damp, in part from condensation on the hull, to foster the ideal conditions necessary for detonation. What most likely caused the second event was the rupture of a main steam line, carrying steam under extreme pressure. This was Turner's theory from the beginning. The fracture could have been caused by the direct force of the initial explosion, or by cold seawater entering boiler room number one and coming into contact with the superheated pipe or its surrounding fixtures, causing a potentially explosive condition known as thermal shock. The fact is, immediately after the torpedo exploded, steam pressure within the ship plummeted. An engineer in the starboard high-pressure turbine room reported that pressure in the main line dropped to 50 pounds in a few seconds, roughly a quarter of what it should have been. In the end, Schwieger's attack on the Lusitania succeeded because of a chance confluence of forces. Even the tiniest alteration in a single vector could have saved the ship. Had Captain Turner not had to wait the extra 2 hours for the transfer of passengers from the Cameronia, he likely would have passed Schwieger in the fog when U-20 was submerged and on its way home. For that matter, even the brief delay caused by the last-minute disembarkation of Turner's niece could have placed the ship in harm's way. More importantly, had Turner not been compelled to shut down the fourth boiler room to save money, he could have sped across the Atlantic at 25 knots, covering an additional 110 miles a day, and been safely to Liverpool before Schwieger even entered the Celtic Sea. Fog was an important factor, too. Had it persisted just a half hour longer, neither vessel would have seen the other, and Schwieger would have continued on his way. Then there was the almost miraculous fact that Schwieger's attack even succeeded. Had Captain Turner not made that final turn to starboard, Schwieger would have had no hope of catching up. What's more, the torpedo actually worked. Defying his own experience and the 60% failure rate calculated by the German Navy, it did exactly what it was supposed to do. Not only that, it struck precisely the right place in the Lusitania's hull to guarantee disaster by allowing seawater to fill the starboard longitudinal bunkers and thereby produce a fatal list. No one familiar with ship construction and torpedo dynamics would have guessed that a single torpedo could sink a ship as big as the Lusitania, let alone do so in just 18 minutes. Schwieger's earlier attack on the Candidate required a torpedo and multiple shells from his deck gun. His attack later that same day on the Centurion required 2 torpedoes. And almost exactly a year later, on May 8, 1916, he would need 3 torpedoes to sink the White Star liner Cymric, which even then stayed afloat for another 28 hours. All 3 ships were a fraction of the Lusitania's size. Moreover, Schwieger had overestimated the ship's speed. He calculated 22 knots when in fact the ship was moving at only 18. Had he gauged the speed correctly and timed his shot accordingly, the torpedo would have struck the hull farther back, amidships, possibly with less catastrophic effect, and certainly with the result that the many crew members killed instantly in the luggage room would have survived to assist in launching the lifeboats. The steam line might not have failed. If Turner had been able to keep the ship under power, he might have made it to Queenstown, or succeeded in beaching the ship, or even leveraged its extraordinary agility to turn and ram U-20. However, it also seems likely that if the Lusitania had not been so visibly crippled, Schwieger might have come back for a second shot. Really, the only good piece of luck that Friday was the weather. The water was preternaturally calm, the day sunny and warm. Even a modest sea would have swept survivors from their floating oars and boxes and planks of wood, and likely swamped overloaded lifeboats. At one point, Survivor Ogden Hammond's boat had 75 people aboard. Its gunwales were only 6 inches above the water. The benign conditions of the day saved scores of lives, if not hundreds. Washington, Berlin,